Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So when Americans finally get around to dealing with healthcare policy, they tend to think in terms of groups, family plans, family groups, employer plans. And you know, one of the key problems of the Affordable Care Act right now is that the lone wolves out there, single invincible consumers, are not signing up. Healthcare, not a priority for them or for young people. It's more a priority for their worrying parents than for them, you might say, hence the provision that families can keep kids on their policies up until age 26. But it all still doesn't add up. Healthcare is a place in America where we do not act like one big, happy, healthy family. And the numbers are getting worse. Joining us now are Elizabeth Bradley, professor of public health at Yale University, and Lauren Taylor, presidential scholar at Harvard Divinity School. They're the co-authors of The American Healthcare Paradox. Welcome.
Hello, John.
Hi, John.
So what is the paradox here? And as we attempt to figure out what's going on administratively with the Affordable Care Act, there are some deep sort of sociological and philosophical issues in healthcare in America that are really preventing us from seeing the playing field. Elizabeth?
You're absolutely right. The central paradox of the American healthcare system is that we're spending almost double what the average of most countries in Western Europe and Scandinavia are spending, and yet our health outcomes are among the very worst for some very critical health outcomes, including the onset of adult diabetes, heart disease, disability, infant mortality, maternal mortality. It goes on and on.
Lauren, it's amazing. You know, we've already discussed this hour about immigration and how we love to think in terms of keeping families together in our immigration policy. But when it comes to health care, we don't really think that way. You go to an emergency room and see people who are in a completely different state than individuals who have jobs and who might have a more traditional insurance policy.
Absolutely. And I think what you're hitting on to some extent is just how individualistic we've really crafted the system to be. You know, we often think of health as an individual matter, something created through personal accountability, a one-to-one relationship with physicians. And yet, you know, your family and the town you live in, the state you live in, have real influence on our health. And I think recognizing that and acting on that is part of the challenge.
Lauren, the system as we've created it really fights the infrastructure that's already in place in terms of families and communities because of this individualistic approach. How does that work in practice?
Sure. Well, I think there's just something of a misconception in some ways about even what basic insurance is. I think many people we spoke to in the course of writing this book, we would speak to them and say, you know, how do you think your health is created or what makes your health? And they say, well, I purchase health insurance and that's a product that I buy. And then I go to my doctor and he gives me medications or what have you. And we often miss that as soon as you enroll into an insurance plan, what you're really doing is joining a risk pool, joining a community of people who you're placing some degree of trust in because you feel like, you know what, if I'm healthy and someone else is sick, the money that I pay for insurance goes to cover their care and vice versa. And so I think there is a real struggle and a tension between our individualist tendencies and our desire to be self-reliant and the rugged cowboy myth.
Elizabeth Bradley, you know, one of the issues that you discover as you look at systems abroad, that they make much bigger investments in broad social programs. They aggregate people into national groups and invest in their health in ways that don't involve medicine. It may involve food support or education, those kinds of things.
Exactly. In the United States, we're really depending on a medical care system to address some of the social and the economic and the behavioral factors that are the root causes of our poor health. When we look at other countries in the high-income areas, they look more carefully at the whole picture. They understand the interconnectedness between one's nutrition and exercise and the way one's educated and where one lives and how one works and sleeps, etc., and actual medical care. They understand these together, they budget them together, and ultimately they can invest more wisely, picking the proper medication, if you will, even if that's a better school, or better housing for the right problem the patient and the community may be facing.
So do you think there's an incompatibility, Elizabeth, between individual freedom and public health, and that it's going to always be harder for this style of democracy to put a medical fix on the back end of society's individual choices?
I don't think it's a fundamental conflict. It certainly is a balance. It's a tension that we have to face, we have to talk about. We're really hoping this book will promote the dialogue on that, promote the discourse so we talk more about those issues and less about just how much is that doctor going to get paid. The fundamental issues for us is to come to who is really accountable for health. Who is it individual, is it the community, or is it a little of both? In the most successful countries, those we found in Scandinavia, they were able to craft this balance very carefully. Heavily democratic, heavily elected, localized, decentralized systems that nonetheless had a broad conception of health to just understand the science. The bottom line is the social determinants of health are much more predictive of how a population will do than medical determinants of health. And once a country and a populace understands that, I think crafting the balance between individualism and social welfare can really be done effectively.
So, Lauren Taylor, when you hear all this discussion about, well, when we get the website to work at health.gov, then we'll be on the right road. What's your reaction to that?
You know, the ACA and the Health Care Reform Act that we're currently embroiled in really is quite narrowly focused. It feels like a huge reform, and I think that's partly because it is a huge reform. You know, it was 1,300 pages, but health is about more than health care, and we really need to distinguish clearly between those two things. Health care is a means to an end, and health is the end. And in fact, it's not really the most powerful means. A lot of the science says that health care makes up about 10% of major health outcomes, whereas social, behavioral, and environmental factors create more than 60% of your health. So we've been relying on this lever that is health care, and we haven't been seeing great results. And I think it's time to reconsider that approach.
Lauren Taylor and Elizabeth Bradley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Bradley is professor of public health at Yale University. Lauren Taylor, presidential scholar at Harvard Divinity School. They are the co-authors of The American Healthcare Paradox.